And welcome in to the 2024 Spring FS Ag Roundtable. We are live at the Patton Block on the third floor in downtown Monmouth. Our sponsors today include our corporate partner, Growmark FS, and our local West Central FS office, also Midwest Bank, Big River Resources, and our other sponsors include Monmouth College, Elliott Brothers Seed Company, A. Eugene Miller Agency, Patton Block Grill and Brew Pub, OSF Holy Family Healthcare, Compeer Financial, and our longtime partners, the Warren Henderson Farm Bureau. We'll introduce our moderator and the panel in just a moment. First, let's hear from our two corporate sponsors. This program would not be possible without the continued support of West Central FS and their corporate office, Growmark FS. Rich DeShepper is with us today. He's one of the managers. Welcome, Rich.
Thank you. Now, West Central FS and Growmark greatly appreciate Vanessa and WRAM Radio to host this roundtable. We think it's great that the industry leaders that are represented here today will discuss some of the great topics, the hot topics that's going on in agriculture. We just feel so fortunate to be a part of this. I am stepping in for Brendan Marshall today, who's a little under the weather. He misses being here. He takes a lot of pride in the job he does working with the local growers. As an advisor and as a partner, but he also likes to be an advocate of this program as well.
Thank you very much, Rich DeShepper with Growmark FS. Also, Chris Gavin with Midwest Bank, who has changed his role just a little bit. You want to tell us about that?
Just a little bit, yes. Last December, I guess, we announced that Aaron Jensen is going to be the 18th president of Midwest Bank. I'm staying on as CEO and also be serving as president of our parent company, Western Illinois Bank Shares. And my boss, Gus Hart, is moving up to chairman in his role with the company. So yeah, we're excited about some changes and look forward to it. I'd echo Rich's thought. It's always a great event, and we love working with Vanessa and all of her partners and putting this on. Thank you very much.
You are most welcome. And we'll introduce Jake Armstrong, who's the Warren Henderson Farm Bureau president, also our longtime partner. Welcome back, Jake.
Thanks for having me again. I look forward to these every 6 months so I can just sit here and learn and grow from all these people who know a lot more than me. So happy to be here and happy to sponsor.
Thank you for being here. And would you like to introduce the new manager of the Farm Bureau?
Yeah, so change is just in the air in Monmouth, Illinois. We hired a new manager, Ashlyn Quinn. Our previous manager, Gina Long, actually decided to start farming with her family. So we're excited for her, happy for her, and we're excited to welcome Ashlyn on. So far, been on about a month, doing a great job. So excited to see what happens there.
Welcome, Ashlyn.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Like Jake said, just happy to be here and learn.
Glad to have you here today. All right. Also with us, I'd like to point out our legislators from right to left. We'll start with State Representative Dan Swanson. Welcome back, Dan.
Thank you, Vanessa. Always a pleasure to be here. And like everyone else has said, it's just a great learning adventure for me and I think for my colleagues. It gives us an opportunity to see what's going on at the grassroots in our communities so we can take those challenges and take the information back to Springfield and incorporate that in our decisions too. So very much appreciate being here.
Yes, glad to have you here. And we will have a legislative section led by Mike a little bit later on. Senator Neil Anderson also with us. Welcome back, Senator Anderson.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Vanessa. Always good to be here. And just to echo what Representative Swanson said, this is so important to us as legislators. And I know I can speak for all of us here. This is the opportunity where we get to hear the feedback and being representatives, we can't do our job without hearing from people. So this is just one tool in the toolbox of being able to do our job properly.
Thank you for being here. And Senator Mike Halpin is with us. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back. I always appreciate being here and, again, learning from everyone in the room and having a conversation about paths forward in the Illinois legislature.
Okay, thank you. Ron Moore with us. He is our past American Soybean Association president. Congratulations on all of your awards and successful operation, Ron. It's so good to have you back.
Well, thank you, Vanessa. I thoroughly enjoy coming to these things. You don't often get to have conversations with the quality of people that are here at this roundtable, and so I really cherish the opportunity to be here. Thank you.
glad to have you here. You know, we get a lot of feedback from non-farmers on this program. They had no idea how much agriculture affects them, the non-farmer, when it comes to gas, the grocery store, legislation. It is quite amazing to see the impact on a global level as well as local. Holly Spangler with us, editor of Prairie Farmer Magazine and executive director of the Farm Progress Show. Welcome.
Thank you, Vanessa. It's always good to be here and see everybody. And I sit here and take notes as well for future stories. So it's always a good morning, just like Ron says, just to get to hear from everybody and to exchange some ideas. And hopefully that lands for your audience, too, and in ways that they say, gosh, I didn't know that. So
thank you, Holly. David Zimmerman with us, Big River Resources CEO and president, also a longtime advertiser. Thanks for your support of our local programming.
Oh, you're most welcome, Vanessa. And great to be here, as always. Just such a great group here. I'm going to echo some comments that Holly and Jake made here. I mean, what a great group of policymakers and advocacy and business and of course, broadcasting. So it's a great group. Always look forward to the conversations we have.
And also Rob Elliott with us. Thank you so much, Rob. You have been instrumental in these programs, longtime member and also a farmer. Thanks for being here.
You bet. Thanks, Vanessa. I certainly appreciate the opportunity. It's been mentioned about the learning opportunity for this group, and hopefully this, more importantly, it's a learning opportunity for the broader audience that's listening and an opportunity to communicate about some issues that are so critical to not just farmers, but our ag community. And in my mind, anyway, I think we're kind of in a place where we're reaching a fairly critical juncture here. We've got a lot of opportunities ahead, but certainly a lot of challenges that may stand in the way of those opportunities. So shifting dynamics in our economy are going to have impact whether we like it or not. So if we can command our destiny, we're probably all money ahead. And so thank you again.
Yes, and you are right. We are at a critical juncture. So thanks for pointing that out. Also, my team today producing Mike Weaver on the board today. Engineering is Kelsey Crane. Our teammate today include Kaylee Foster, Kendra Hughes, Alan McKee is with us, and also Mayor Rod Davies on hand, and our new Maple City Area Partnership for Economic Development Director and Monmouth Area Chamber of Commerce Director Andrea Monroe with us. I'm going to turn things over to our host. It is Mr. Mike Adams, longtime ag broadcaster, retired, but once again, friend of the radio station, friend of this group of people, came back to moderate today's event. Mike, it's all yours, and thank you.
Thank you, Vanessa. Long term is a nice way of saying old, so it's always good to be back. Monmouth is like another home to me. I've been here so many times working with you and the radio station and agriculture and in this area, in this community, and WREM does a great job of promoting agriculture, educating people about agriculture. We need that. When I think about the topics we'll talk about today, you know, I've been retired now 2 years. Biggest change is I don't get up as early as I used to. That's the main thing. But I still try to watch some of these issues, and it's amazing how some of them are issues we've talked about for years and years and years. A little different spin or a little different angle on them, but they're still around in various forms. But there are always new challenges, and as Rob said, new opportunities as well. And I think we are at quite a point where agriculture, we're at that fork in the road, depending on certain things, not just in society, but with government and things like that, that can open up tremendous new doors for agriculture. But those doors can be shut in our faces just as quickly, and we've seen that happen many times over the years. So here we go, a new set of challenges that we're going to talk about today. Great group that we have here. You've heard from all of them. I want to start with our legislators and kind of get an update, what's going on, what we need to know, what they're working on, what we should be watching for in the state legislature. So Dan Swanson, our state representative, 71st state representative, bring us up to date. What's going on? What are you particularly interested in? What should we be watching for?
Well, thank you, Mike, and it's always a pleasure to be on this team and have you lead us in the discussions. Several pieces of legislation affecting agriculture are looking us in the face. One piece of legislation completely bans Roundup. Another bans dicamba. Another piece of legislation bans 2,4-D ester. There's also legislation to ban the use of pesticides on seed, corn, soybean, any type of seed that would go in a planter we would use on the farm. So those are some we're really watching closely. Another piece of legislation that would really have affected our farmers was House Bill 1634, and that piece of legislation would have required Illinois to comply with California emission standards. And basically what it would have done for us in the ag industry, if you had a truck older than a 2014, it would not allow, you would not be able to put a license plate to register that vehicle. Matter of fact, if you drove it out on the highway or pulled it out on a road, you would not receive a ticket, your vehicle would be seized. And it not only applied to us in Illinois, but also trucks traveling through Illinois. So the example I use, a new combine manufactured in Nebraska going to a farmer in Ohio, if that truck was older than a 2014, the potential would be, or most likely outcome would be, the truck and combine and everything would be seized when it hit the Illinois borders. So, you know, some pretty drastic stuff. I think we've got that tampered down for now. The governor spoke briefly, somewhat in opposition to that type of dramatic change. But also part of that legislation took the control away from the Illinois legislators, in that every 6 months when California would change that emission control standard, Illinois would have to follow suit within 6 months. So a lot of legislation affecting primarily, you know, the livestock industry and the corn bean growers in Illinois. So I'll stop at that and leave some opportunities for other members.
I do want to ask you a question, and we'll get into this more as we go along, but I know California seems to think they can set the policy for the whole country, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on. But you mentioned the different ag products that are potentially banned, certainly restrictions on their use. As a legislator, how much pressure, how much input do you get from the public that have safety concerns about these things, and then trying to balance that with the needs of the farmers to produce the food that we need? So tell us about that dynamic that takes place for you as a legislator.
Certainly we get calls and we get emails on those topics, and we take those in consideration. But then we look at the ag industry as a whole, the number one industry and business in the state of Illinois, we have to weigh that too. We look at what the plus and minus to each of those equations are, and certainly we understand the impacts it has on some of the orchards, and there are already regulations that we take tests for when we do applications of things, the weather conditions and the temperatures and the winds and all those that we encourage and farmers are to follow. So we address that too, as they need to be more cognizant of what the weather conditions are and the use of those chemicals during the right time of the year and stuff. So it's something we take into consideration. We certainly listen to them. We certainly apply that, but bottom line, we look at what's the overall state impact too.
Okay, let's go to 47th District State Senator Neil Anderson. Neil, good to talk with you. Kind of bring us up to date. What are you most focused on right now?
Well, as Representative Swanson said, it seems like there's an assault this session on ag. Coming, I think there's 8 bills specifically focused on pesticide regulation. And to your point, to what you just said, I mean, that's the one thing people have to understand that are outside of ag and ag business is they want, you know, they claim to want to protect the environment, but at the same time, no farmer is going to put his land at risk. He is the best steward for that land, and he is not going to put that in jeopardy. And I think that's something that a lot of people forget. The same goes with any conservation with hunters, you know. Of course, there's always bad actors, but the general rule of thumb is farmers aren't going to shoot themselves in the foot. In the Senate, we have Senator Kaler has a bill dealing with the estate tax. It's a good bill. I mean, it's better than what we have now. It's something that definitely needs to change. would I want something a little better? Yeah. Senator Tracy and I have a bill that completely matches the Fed, and it's pretty simple. There's some caveats in Senator Kaler's bill, but overall, I think it's a pretty good bill that will make things a lot better for a state tax for our farmers and landowners. And then Senator McClure has a bill that basically just says that these CO2 carbon pipelines cannot use eminent domain, and I think that's it's a great bill. And whether we see it called for a vote or not is we will see. I would guess not. But that's another good piece of legislation, and I think a lot of people have. A lot of people have said to these pipelines, and I think what led up to them pulling their bid for it was a lot of legislators on both sides of the aisle are saying, hey, we're not going to vote for this if there's eminent domain involved. So I think that's putting a lot of pressure on them to go back to the drawing board. It's not dead yet, though.
This whole issue of these pipelines, it's a hot issue, and there are strong feelings on both sides. So in your position, you have to kind of weigh that, don't you? I mean, the pluses and minuses, and try to do what's fair for the people overall, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, what's fair and what's right are two different things. I mean, what's right is for me to represent my constituents and of the 47th district, and they have spoken loud and clear that they don't want any part of this unless they're going to have a say. If a farmer says, yeah, it's okay to put that through here, fine, I don't mind. But the moment that eminent domain is even talked about, that's where I'm out. And that's property rights is one of the most fundamental rights we have as Americans, and that is not something I'm going to tread on.
Do you get a lot of input on it? Do you hear a lot from a lot of people?
Yeah, we hear quite a bit. Yeah, quite a bit at our office.
I would think so. All right. And finally, as we have Mike Halpin with us, and it's good to talk with him as we as you look at these issues, are there other issues that you're hearing about in your office?
You know, I'd echo what both Dan and Neil said, and I would note that a lot of those bills are over on the House side that would, you know, ban a lot of the various pesticides. We don't see that as much over in the Senate. And I would say that the bills, for the most part, are coming from people in good faith that think there's a problem. But the reality is, I'm not sure how many of them have been to a farm or talked with farmers or talked with industry as to how it affects everything up the line. And I agree 100% with Neil when he talks about the farmer not wanting to do something that's going to long-term, you know, hurt people that he's going to sell his product to, but also hurt the land and hurt his own business in the future. So I think we need to have those conversations and really educate some of the sponsors of these bills as to how it affects everything down the line. In addition to that, I'm a supporter of Senator Kaler's bill on the estate tax. I do think it is fairly narrow, but the discussions we've had is there's realistically a cost to it. You know, that's going to be revenue that isn't collected by the state. And in a budget year where we're looking at kind of a pullback in state revenue to begin with, it'd be tough to get in the full repeal or full match to the federal government. So we're having those discussions, and hopefully we can get something that'll make it a little bit easier, at least for those family farmers that are going to continue to have the farm in the family, and ease the pressure on their heirs. And then lastly, I've signed on to a bill that would increase the cover crop program, the appropriations for cover crop programs, and expand the acreage of folks that'd be eligible for those farmers that do want to take advantage of that activity. And again, that's going to be dependent on the budget and whether we can put the money together to do that. But I think, you know, sustainable farming is an important issue for many of the farmers here in the local area, and we want to make sure they have the tools and the incentives to do that if they want to.
Do you hear from a lot of farmers about cover crops?
Yeah, you know, I do. And mostly it's most recently talked with a group from Henry County that were interested in expanding the program, and some testimonials about how it was difficult to start up. once they got going and they understood it, you know, really got, like any other thing, once you practice, you know how to make it efficient and get better at it. And so I think there's an education piece to that as well. And it's not for everyone, but for the folks that want to get that started up and get that practice, we need to give them that little boost at the beginning.
Yeah, I talk to farmers and some are all for it, some are totally against it, others are just curious or have questions or concerns. They're not that they're against it, but they're not sure it works for them. So there are a lot of decisions to be made there.
Yeah, it's tough to take that jump and like take a risk and do something different than what you've done, which typically works, right? The reason you've done it for so long is because it works for you. So there's always risk involved when you change anything up, but it's a good option to have for folks if they want it.
Right, Senator, thank you very much. So those are some of the things we're looking at. Kind of gets us started on some of the issues that we're going to be talking about here in our roundtable, even though we're in a square. But
Mike, if I might comment to the legislators' comments, I would almost think in reality your biggest hurdle that you have to overcome is sorting out what's reality and what are comments or thoughts based on facts versus emotion. Just like the bill that wanted to turn us into a little California. Was there any facts at all probably in that? Probably built on emotion as much as anything else. And I think that's kind of the world we seem to be living in.
Yeah, I would agree. It was, it looked good. It felt good. So I'm going to run the bill. And then when reality struck, it was, oh my gosh, what I get into, I think, is what happened. We all have good intentions. It's just sometimes they're challenged with what we thought were good intentions may not always be good intentions. And one of the things I like to encourage legislators, and this is the Farm Bureau, the adopted legislator, on some of these pieces of legislation, I'll ask them, are you an adopted legislator? Yes. Have you talked to your legislative Farm Bureau county? And most times they'll tip their head and say no. I said, well, that's why we do these programs, so you can get that. And I think that if we remind them of that, that they are an adopted legislator, that they do have a quick reach to the ag industry, that they'll take advantage of those opportunities too. But yeah, a lot of it is the emotions and great comments, Rob.
One of the areas that holds tremendous potential for agriculture, but also a lot of challenges from the government and other places, and that's in renewable fuels and this whole move now to sustainable aviation fuel. And it looks like the door is a little more open for the soybean side right now than it is for the corn side as we wait for some decisions to be made there. Ron Moore, as you look at that from a biodiesel standpoint, huge opportunity there, and you're already starting to see some of that come true.
Yeah, we are. That's a great new use for the soybean oil that we have. And one of the challenges is because we're going to be producing or crushing soybeans for the oil is what are we going to do with all the meal that we're going to have to do something with, feed it to livestock or export it. And so those are all things that need to be shaken out over the next couple of years. One of the things that concerns me about that is there is a, as I understand from the media, that there's a plant in Georgia that is making sustainable aviation fuel, but the feedstock is sugarcane from Brazil. The ethanol made from sugarcane from Brazil, which is contradictory to supporting U.S. agriculture, which there's lots of things that the U.S. government does that are contradictory that needs to be fleshed out. But the potential there is great for both soybeans and corn for sustainable aviation fuel.
It's funny because when you said that about the oil and the meal, I remember that when biodiesel was developed, it was because we had too much oil. We didn't know what to do with the oil, right?
Yeah, and it was dirt cheap, and that was a drag on the soybean price. So that's why they developed biodiesel, I don't know, 30 years ago, somewhere in that area. And so things have come full circle. Now we need to, you know, find a home for the meal.
For sure. Well, I want to bring in David Zimmerman, CEO of Big River Resources. So from an ethanol side and trying to meet all these standards to have ethanol be, you know, sustainable aviation fuel, where are we on that right now?
Well, it's a slow process for sure. And Ron's 100% right. Brazilian sugarcane is what's supplying the Soperton, Georgia plant as of right now. And this is a problem we're seeing. You know, we've had an adversarial relationship with Brazil over the years at times. I think it's probably as adversarial as I've seen it in a long time. And part of it is there's no reciprocity between these government programs. Brazil has an 18% tariff on ethanol going to Brazil currently. They have their own decarbonization program called RenovaBio, where American producers are not allowed to participate. At the same time, conversely, the Brazilians are allowed to participate in the renewable fuel standard, and they're also allowed to supply Brazilian feedstock to our just getting started SAF industry. So in the interest of fairness, things are lopsided, and I know there is federally a little bit of a growing outcry for some fairness here. But that being said, all of this decarbonization, whether it goes towards SAF or even in Illinois, there is a clean fuel standard bill that Senator Kaler has. I think it might still be in committee. You guys would know more than I on that. But the overall direction of decarbonization is still in process, but it is a slow one. And, you know, I mentioned in our annual meeting that we're taking steps at Galva. You know, we're spending some money there to upgrade and increase efficiencies, produce our own power, and things that are going to lower our carbon footprint. And these are all for whether it be SAF or low carbon over-the-road fuel.
I've fought this for years. I always try to get through to our federal government that the RFS was intended to promote our renewable fuels industry, not everybody else's, but sometimes it does get mixed up. So where are you at Big River in this goal to, you know, be carbon neutral? Where are you on that?
We're in process. We at Galva, like I mentioned, we're going to be installing combined heat and power, and that plant is currently in shutdown right now. So we're making some of those tie-ins, and what that means essentially is we will no longer be required to pull any electricity off the Illinois grid. We'll produce it all for ourselves and utilize it all within our plant. That's one thing that we're doing. The other thing is, you know, efficiency is the name of the game rather than outright production in this environment. Now, production's good as long as you don't increase your energy usage as you're trying to achieve that additional production. But it really is about efficiency and lowering your carbon footprint at this point, and we're moving in that direction. And just let me say that the timing of it's not terrible. I mean, these are 20-year-old facilities that a lot of major equipment is starting to basically reach the end of its usable life. So the opportunity is there, if the policy is right, to upgrade that equipment to more efficient and lower carbon equipment.
The potential here, I was reading the numbers the other day, and I wish I could remember them, but they were staggering how much aviation fuel we use. So if you can get into that market.
Yeah, that's domestically by 2050, I've heard estimates of 30 billion gallon market. Worldwide, 100 billion gallons. So yeah, it really is, you know, agriculture in general is looking at that as the next potential demand center. You know, the ethanol demand center that we experienced in 07 to 15. And, you know, we'll talk about crop size here, I assume, before the morning's over, but right. We're looking at a pretty sizable crop in 2024. It has that potential as of right now with large carryouts, and, you know, we're 450 prices. So we need those demand centers. We need to be developing them now in order to avoid, you know, potential 1998-type farm prices.
And Rob Elliott, the government seems to keep moving the goalposts for ethanol on this. You're trying to meet these standards, whether it's with vehicles and the constant push to go to EVs all the time, so that can limit the market for vehicle use for ethanol. So that's an issue. And then just meeting the standards to get into this SAF program. So it's been hard, hasn't it?
It has, Mike, and those were some of the challenges and opportunities I was talking about here on the front end. The whole sustainable aviation fuel is a huge opportunity. policy, particularly in light of if the electrification of our fleet begins to happen, like is being pushed. And I'd like to set that aside and come back to that one too.
Sure.
I have a couple comments there, but but the whole sustainable aviation fuel contingent on several things: lower net carbon intensity score, right, David, and doing that via whatever means. And one of those is the pipeline and carbon sequestration. If that doesn't happen, it makes that a bit more difficult. The other thing is how is that carbon intensity scored? At Commodity Classic, it was thought that Secretary Vilsack and his sidekick Michael Reagan from EPA would make the announcement about this GREET model and modifications. That hasn't happened as of yet, so they didn't do it that day. But the hope is that we don't handcuff agriculture and the ethanol industry and being able to be part of that carbon intensity reduction. The GREET model, as we've talked about before, is kind of the gold standard. It includes ag modifications on an updated basis for Michael Wang up at Argonne Lab, by Burr Ridge up southwest suburbs of Chicago. So they've always been allies of us in our industry, as opposed to using European models, which at one point was where EPA was going to go.
One of the ironies of all this discussion has been it's almost brought, in some ways, the big oil industry and the ethanol industries together. Yes. In the battle against EVs, if you will, or the transition thereof, you know.
Sure. I would mention that last week, I think it was Friday, Illinois Corn with Illinois Manufacturers Association, along with University of Illinois Champaign and Chicago, hosted up in the suburbs of Chicago a sustainable aviation fuel conference. And those in attendance were the folks like American Airlines, United, Southwest, Boeing, and the like. I believe the governor spoke up there and was supportive of where this could all go. But again, that's an ongoing process that has to take shape correctly if our ag and rural economies are going to be able to take advantage of that.
And it shows how this has developed. When the ethanol industry got started, if you just said, someday you're going to be working with the airlines to work on providing them fuel, we couldn't even have imagined that. We're just trying to get people to put ethanol in their gas tanks. So that shows how all this has progressed and how these things intertwine and are so key. Another area of this, and I want to ask Jake to come in on this, this whole business about carbon markets. We've been down this road before over the years, and it hasn't always gone very far or gone very well. But there's this potential, but skepticism too, because do we have a real market? Who do you turn this over to? Who do you trust? What are you hearing, Jake?
So the best way I've heard this described is it's the Wild West, right? You put it perfectly, as in, who do you trust? Is there actually a market? Is there actually value? If there's value, is it actually $10 an acre? Is it $100 an acre? Is it $1,000 an acre? What's the actual value, you know? So when I talk with my customers on these programs, it's a lot of skepticism and uncertainty, and there's just a lot of people who feel there is a value there, but it's not that $10 or $15 an acre that people are wanting to pay. They think it's more, and they're looking to hold out a little longer. But how we measure what carbon we sequester with the plants that we have, I don't think that science is fully there yet to properly measure that so that we can have a fair value to it. So I think there's a lot of skepticism in the countryside. I think if we get some data and we get some science behind it, I think people will jump on it pretty quickly. I just don't know if the trust is there yet. And as to who that should be, I mean, my first thought's extension and research, but I don't have a specific answer for that.
Ron Moore, you've been down this road a few times. Still more questions than answers, I think, in a lot of cases.
Yeah, that's true. And like Jake said, one of the things is how much carbon can I sequester on my farming operation? How much I've got grassland and pasture? How much can I sequester there? There's a wide variety, in from 2 tons per acre to 20 tons per acre. And if you're just going to do some of the things that we've always done, no-till and add now cover crops, 10 to 20 bucks an acre when you put in $1,000 of input costs on an acre of corn is irrelevant. And until that becomes a relevant number, I don't think you're going to see widespread adoption of carbon sequestration activities.
Bring in Holly Spangler. I know, Holly, you talk to a lot of farmers about this. And what do you hear from them? And as far as what they're hearing from people trying to get their business, basically?
Yeah, there's no shortage of organizations looking to work their way into that market. And just exactly what Ron was saying, you know, I think there's a certain amount of this just doesn't sit quite right with farmers. Like, they're going to make the changes that improve, you know, the environment, but somebody else is going to buy that and take credit for it for a price that doesn't really help them that much. And so they haven't adopted, you know, they have not come on board. To Jake's point about it being the Wild West, I've heard it also described as it's an idea in search of a market that hasn't found a price yet. And so, you know, and I think there's just a lot of confusion about it too. You know, everybody's got a deal, you know, and whether that's some of your input suppliers or it's a completely, you know, different third party. It's just that the prices that they're offering have not hit that point that Ron's talking about that actually makes a difference.
Yeah, David. And those are good points. And I think part of the confusion that we're seeing, and I agree with both of those comments on, you know, $10 an acre for a cover crop, but I think part of the confusion we're seeing is there are two different types of markets available here. Voluntary carbon credits are basically just that. They're open markets where Microsoft can come in and offset their emissions via purchasing whatever this farmer did, whether cover crops or whatever. I think there's another path that, if done right, we could realize in the future, and that's the 45Z tax credits, where farmers can be rewarded for those agronomic practices, but it would be funneled through the Inflation Reduction Act and the overall carbon score of a bioprocessing facility. So if I can buy low carbon feedstock, i.e. corn, and I can lower my carbon index score at my bioprocessing facility, I can achieve a greater tax credit in that regard. And I think that program, if extended, it's only a 3-year program beginning in 25 and ending at the end of 27. But as of now, if that were an extended program, I think you'd end up with a much more vibrant farm situation as far as CI, and ultimately better revenues for the producers as well.
That's a great point, David. We actually just did a cover story looking on that idea of how to actually make money with carbon credits, right? So it's that tax credit, I guess you'd say, that 45Z program, but it's a totally different angle to look at and what might actually work.
And there's political uncertainty with the 45Z, whereas the voluntary carbon credits are known and they're understood and they're there today. But yeah, the 45Z definitely has some political risk with it involved.
Okay. Representative Swanson?
Yeah, thank you. One of the things that interests me is, as a producer growing corn and soybeans, as we reduce carbon, what's that going to do to my yields? My crops need those carbons, and is that offset of $10, $20, $100 an acre enough to cover the reduction in my crop loss? And you know, that's always been my concern. Show me what it's going to look like in a zero carbon environment, or as we draw down our carbon, what's my crops going to look like? What's my trees going to look like? You know, that's the thing that worries me the most. You can throw a lot of money at the problem, but will that actually solve the problem and create more? We reduced the lead in our fuels. We went to unleaded fuels in the 70s, and now we put in $70 to $90 worth of sulfur in our crop ground because we no longer have that available through that environment. So that's my concern, is what does a zero carbon world look like, or United States, or Illinois, or Mercer County, whatever, Warren County, our counties around here. So thank you.
You know, I think that's a good point. Ron, I'll ask you about this, because we have these environmental goals out there to reach these things, be carbon neutral, whatever it is. But there are already some projections out there to hit some of these goals that the environmentalists want us to hit. could pretty much wipe out production agriculture. I mean, as we know it. And how do you, you've reached your environmental goals, but people are starving. So, you know, there's got to be some balance in here.
Well, yeah, you're right that the naysayers all, the doomsdaysayers say that. But to me, people still got to eat. And if you end up with a situation where there's not enough food in the world, or not enough food in this country to feed our own people, the policies will change. Because you'll have such an outcry if in the grocery store, if the aisles are 20% higher than they are now in for prices, I think you'll see policies change. So I'm not terribly concerned about we're not going to have enough production to feed our country. People still have to eat, and I think that's the overriding sentiment that I have.
My concern is that we take that for granted so much in this country that we enact policies that wind up making it a lot harder to produce that food. We've talked about California. California's been referenced. I mean, it seems like California passes something and it ripples through the whole country because we have people don't understand why something that's passed in California affects somebody in Illinois, but it certainly does because of commerce and doing business. And so whether it's pork production or tailpipe emissions or whatever it may be, it affects folks right here in Warren County, even though it was passed in California. Rob, I know that from a corn grower standpoint, you know, there are a lot of frustrations here of California dictating policy to the rest of the country.
You bet. And I guess the recent example that I mentioned earlier is this last week, it's called the tailpipe rule that came from EPA. And it's been floating out there for about a year now. So in essence, this is an edict that's kind of come down from a regulatory body, the EPA. But I think this whole electrification of our vehicle fleet, the problem is it just neglects reality. It's not a well thought out strategic future plan, none of that. It just totally misses what the goal is, and the goal is to reduce air pollution. There are ways to do that other than just saying electrification is the exact answer to all of our problems. So just two figures I'll throw out that were part of this update. We talked about them one time here a long time ago, but in a previous session. By 2027, there would have to be 30% of new build vehicles be electric. By 2032, that goes up to 69% of the vehicle fleet of new offers would have to be electric. The really troubling part of this is there's a study done by the University of Nebraska. And basically what that study says is this electrification plan could have as devastating effects on our rural economies as the 80s farm crisis. So if you think back, and I got asked to kind of think about this a little bit, so I made a couple of notes. If you think back, what are the similarities? We had high interest rates. We had a pretty good economy from a farm in the late 70s, which amped up farmland prices a little bit. We had inflation going like crazy. I tell my wife, hurry up and get to the store. The tennis shoes for the kids will cost $20 more tomorrow, you know. And that was the reality of life there. Jimmy Carter put on the grain embargo. We had a lot of good exports going at the time. Markets were doing well. That all ceased. Markets tanked. Prices went down. And as a result, what happens? Farmland values went down. Balance sheets were affected. People couldn't pay their interest to Chris Gavin at Midwest Bank. We saw farm foreclosures, that type of thing, in our economy, probably the worst since the Depression days. And basically what Nebraska's saying is, if this happens at the rate that they're talking about, that corn prices would fall by 50%, we would lose a good portion of that ethanol market. Farmland values would go down by $100 billion, and on we go. We're back to the 80s, or who knows, maybe worse, if sustainable aviation fuel doesn't kick in and we've got a, you know, a bit of a savior for all this mess. We're in trouble. Mm-hmm. And I don't think a lot of us realize how close that impact could really be. We're talking, you know, half a dozen years down the road here, and we could be in a heap of something, you know. And so, again, that's a wake-up call for all of us, I think.
I want to ask our two state senators, because I realize this is federal policy coming at us here, but I want to get your perspective on this. My thoughts for the last 3.5 years on the EVs has been, it might be something that's a good goal, but let's have a better transition into it instead of trying to drink from a fire hose here and force everything down when we don't have the grid for it and everything else. How frustrating is it to, do you feel like Washington's forcing this down our throats or trying to, and how do you feel that from a state standpoint?
Yeah, they are forcing it, and what's even more frustrating is they see now that it shouldn't be forced. There's a great article out there, and you can Google it. The inventor of the Toyota Prius did an article when EVs kind of went mainstream, you know, with Tesla, and he said, this is never going to work, this is a bad idea, and you watch, they're going to start backpedaling. And he just wrote another article here recently, and it was a see, I told you so. And you see companies like Ford and Chevy just announcing here in the last, you know, 6 months that they're going to go back to start making the plug-in hybrids, the hybrids that also have a gas engine, because people just aren't buying the EVs, even though they're building them and selling them at a loss to try to get them on the market. People just ain't buying them. And not to mention the hypocrisy of the enviros out there talking about this is so great for carbon and all this, but yet they've never seen a strip mine. So it's super frustrating. We just heard a bill in the executive committee this last week that would regulate how we store EV batteries, because they're so flammable. Mm-hmm. And to put out an EV battery fire, as a fireman myself, we have to have special training on how to put these out, because it burns so hot and so fast. So yeah, it's beyond frustrating.
Mike, if I could comment, and great point from Neil there. I think I shared with this group that Mark Johnson from Toyota, who is their government affairs guy, and he's a Fulton County kid, yeah, by from background, but he spoke at Commodity Classic and gave a wonderful rendition of all the dynamics between, you know, the battery electric and the hybrid. And the one graphic that is so telling is that if you take, and I'm not an expert, I'm not a scientist, some of you think, probably not very smart. However, if you take the pile of stuff that goes into a full battery electric vehicle, all coming, much of it from folks that don't like us very much, and look at the pile that goes into a hybrid electric vehicle, they could make 90 hybrid electric vehicles for the one they build over here. So if that doesn't tell you something, and it's the perfect avenue to put this Next Generation Fuels Act, you put a little bitty ethanol optimized, supercharged, high compression, small engine into that car driving it, you use a high grade of ethanol, we accomplish all the things we want to from a standpoint of air pollution, but we just refuse to want to look at it.
Yeah, it's been my complaint all along that we're chasing something new and we have something, an industry already here that can produce the results that we supposedly are after, right, David?
That's my issue with these CAFE standards and the EPA is it's short-sighted. And, you know, it's not technology neutral. It's not including the life cycle analysis of what it takes to build that electric vehicle. And it's also ignoring, you know, ethanol has a 46% less carbon footprint than gasoline. You know, the Next Generation Fuels Act is a really good point here. I mean, you raise the octane and you start to decarbonize that today. You don't have to wait for all this infrastructure to be built. So to me, that's a little misleading, and it makes me question, what is the ultimate goal? If it's decarbonization, then why are you ignoring the decarbonization that's right here on your doorstep today?
Yeah, the only life cycle analysis they ever talk about is growing corn.
Yeah.
And they try to find some negative about that. Senator Halpin, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would just say I think in general it's good to have, you know, aspirational goals and actually try to put that into legislation. I think a lot of times that's the only way that we get things kick-started, and then we start addressing those types of problems and find solutions as they come up. So I think, I mean, there's always a balance, right? If we didn't have big pieces of legislation, there would be less, you know, less reason to change or to innovate and continue to do the things we've done in the past. So one of my philosophies is we can pass a bill, we have goals, work towards it, and then troubleshoot and solve problems as they come up. And if it comes to be that we can't reach that standard without negative consequences, we go back in, we change it, we fix things. And I think that's good. That's generally good policy at the end of the day. It gets us further down the road to where we want to be.
The troubling part, though, Mike, and I apologize for interjecting here, but much of what affects us, it never got voted on. It wasn't coming from elected officials based on feedback of their constituents. It's a regulatory mandate that's coming from and driven by, in many cases, just like with this tailpipe rule, the limitless almost funds of environmental foundations. That's what's driving half of what's happening right now. And it's the part that, honestly, we ought to be mad as hell about. So,
or if people do vote for something like Prop 12 in California, now consumers are saying, oh, how come my bacon prices are so much higher? Well, somebody should have explained that maybe a little better before they voted for it.
And I was just joking the other day. I was talking to a member of the media down in Springfield, and I said, you know what we should be doing is I should send and hire a staffer just to sit in California in the legislature and report back to me what we're going to be voting on next year, because that seems to be the way it goes.
Well, you guys probably wish your state legislators out there, if you're a state legislator, you're about like Congress. You pass national laws, it seems like. You don't quite get that same impact always, do you?
No, we certainly don't. But I was going to make a comment, too. This past week in transportation safety, we had legislation in front of us that we were able to stop for now. But it would have allowed electric vehicles to be 2,000 pounds over the weight limit. So instead of an 80,000 pound truck, you go up to 82,000 pounds. But these electric trucks are estimated to be 34% heavier than what a normal semi would be. And as we had the debate, my question that I brought forward was, so we're going to raise the weight limit, but we haven't even talked about the damage it's going to do our road, and we haven't talked about any compensation for a fuel tax with any legislation. And to me, that's got to be step number one, is if they're not paying a fuel tax, the people with electric vehicles even now, all that burden then on fixing our roads falls back on other people. And these electric vehicles are so much heavier when we think about putting an 82,000 pound semi that's hauling 34% less grain, because it's 82,000 pounds even with that. We're going to have more transportation on our highways, our township roads, and county roads, and they certainly are going to need to be compensated to do that repair work also.
Yes, somebody said do they ever consider all these things before they start passing all this? You know, it sounds good. We're going to clean the air in some way, and everybody and people jump on the bandwagon. Oh, then you find out all the other parts that go with that. So, all right, great discussion. We've got a lot more to talk about. I think we're going to take a break here. We got about a 10-minute break. So, Vanessa, we'll turn it back over to you.
Okay, yeah, thank you for the first hour of discussion. It is 10:55. You are listening to WRAM Monmouth, Illinois.